Failsafe, guidance for resilient cloud architectures, developed by Microsoft Services and the Azure Customer Advisory Team.
All right, so let's talk about the various forms of data management stores you have available to you on Azure. Some of them are Microsoft products, some of them are not. So the key thing is, what are the set of capabilities we have available? How do those map to different customer scenarios? And what are the trade-offs that you're making? What's the right combination for your workload? So a couple of key things. There are a wide range of options. We've got relational stores, document stores, graph stores, big data, which is actually a misnomer because it applies to any number of approaches. So we'll be a little bit more discreet than that and pull some of the hype away. For better or for worse, the approaches are polyglot or compositional. You're going to need to use multiple state stores to deliver the solutions that your customers need, and there is no one-size-fits-all. We had a phenomenal 20-year run where you could just hammer things with a relational database and get enough SQL nerds and stuff would work. Again, for better or for worse, that day is also over. But ultimately, these are engineering choices where I'm getting something and I'm giving something up. And there's always this dynamic tension. All right, bum, 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 come on. Okay, so I'm going to actually play this one a little bit later. There's a phenomenal book, 7 Databases in 7 Days, if you want to learn a little bit more about this. I haven't got the audio set up, so you wouldn't be able to hear it anyway. But I highly recommend this book, just kind of giving you a bit of a preview. If you want to learn a little bit more about the landscape, this is one of my preferred go-to resources. Okay. There are now a lot of questions that you need to ask about your data model and about your customer's data model. So I always think of things in terms of the semantic of the storage. I don't care how it's physically implemented. I care about the semantic that it exposes. I don't care that most relational engines are based around B-trees. Couldn't care less. What I care is they expose a set-based relational semantic that allows me to do certain things and doesn't allow me to do certain things. I think about queryability. Relational stores are incredibly queryable. They are the ultimate query experience when treated right. Caches are not queryable. I can ask one question. I have a key. Do you have anything? And there's a whole bunch of stuff in the middle. And this is unfortunate. There are nuances. There are things that look like they'll work at a high level, but once you drill down 5 feet off the deck, they won't. This is especially common in the world of big data. This is where things get very, very nuanced, and people think that technology is magic. Fortunately, it isn't. Functional projection. This is my fancy way of saying, can I take a question or an intent and push it to the server? In the SQL world, this is client cursors versus server cursors. This is one of the reasons Link gets a bit of a bad rap, because it's not always obvious what is the functional projection to the server and what executes locally. If I say select count star from table in SQL, it takes the entire function, pushes it up to the server, executes it very efficiently locally, and brings back an answer. If I were to run the same query against table storage, that is what we like to call an unbounded query. It may never return because it's bringing every single piece of data locally and then adding them up row by row. The ability for the store to project a function, project an aggregation, project a filter is critically important. What kinds of language or what types of expressions do I have? If it's a relational database, it's SQL. So however I get to SQL, doesn't really matter. For tables, it's OData. That's my abilities. But I only get filter on primary key and row key and project, which is take the fields and project them in a different form. Or for the database folks amongst us, we call it select. Scalability. How much scale out do I get? Relational databases are great, but the relational semantics says that I have a symmetric, globally coherent address space. Every piece of data has the same distance from any other piece of data. It's right there in the T-SQL language. There's nothing there that says this data is in one partition and this data is in another partition. A physically separate partition, a network boundary. You go into table storage, and it's right there. I cannot ask a question in table storage or MongoDB without explicitly, or in some cases implicitly, specifying the partitionality of the data. This is incredibly important. This is one of the reasons that it's very easy to scale out table storage, because from the very beginning I had to pick a partition function. Picking one partitioning function versus picking three partitioning functions, it's the same problem. SQL is very hard to scale out. It can be done. We're going to spend some time talking about exactly how you do it. what works and what doesn't, but it's a lot more effort. In general, and most of the people in the SQL community kind of look at me funny when I say this, my default is always baseline storage, the simplest thing that will get the job done. Most applications for their online data management can work very well with tables and blobs. That's generally all they need. It's only when I start getting into rich queryability that I start to look at the relational algebra and the relational systems to answer questions. How easy is it to add or remove capacity? This is directly related to partitioning. To add more capacity to table storage is I add a new partition and then I add a new storage account. These are relatively easy. Adding new databases and reallocating work between them is actually quite challenging. Instrumentation, manageability. If I cannot manage it, I cannot scale it. I don't even know if it's up. So what metrics does the system give me? What do I get for free? What do I have to bake in? Azure readiness. How hard is it to get it on Azure? Well, storage is pretty simple. I just say, give me some storage. SQL is the same thing. Things like MongoDB and other stores, they're a little easier now than they were a few months ago. I can go to the Azure store and just stand them up, but I have to wire up some additional plumbing. This is just specific for .NET, but again, I have an explicit .NET bias in these presentations. It may have been rather apparent by now. How easy is it to get at from .NET? How good is the .NET client? Storage 1.0, I cannot use table storage efficiently. If I'm using the SDK 1.7 and below, I cannot efficiently use table storage. I cannot put multiple schema types in the same table and retrieve them in a single operation because the WCF Astoria storage layer that was used in those versions will not let me. That's a problem. That is no longer true, I'm happy to say. And finally, business continuity. This is, you know, a couple people have raised this. How do I have availability? How do I have ease of use? And how do I prevent the, oh, I just deleted the production site. Can you undo that? Who's had that? Oh, yeah, everyone's seen that. Customer goes and fat fingers something. Actually, let me, quick story time. I have personally been responsible for bringing down an entire manufacturing plant. I fat fingered, anyone remember NIS, Yellow Pages, back in the Solaris days? I fat fingered an identity and authentication replication script, destroyed the production manufacturing login system, and brought everything to a halt for about an hour. So that wasn't too bad. It was only about $150,000 worth of downtime. I know people who have done far worse. But yes, I have absolutely been responsible for the where's the undo button. So understanding what undo options you have available is very important because, let's be honest, your customers and everyone in this room will at some point fat finger something. And I am in the front of that line. Okay, platform options. There are more. These are the key ones that you'll probably run into. We know the relational world pretty well. I'm not going to go into deep detail. I'm just going to talk about some of the nuances of SQL Azure. Document databases. This is really interesting. I'll talk about some. Who's heard of MongoDB? Yeah, pretty much everybody. Great document database, now available on Azure. It's kind of a one-touch experience. Key value stores. Caching is a key value store. I have a key and a blob. Azure Blob Store is a key value store. I have a container name and a blob name and a chunk of binary data. These are key value stores. Graph databases for social networks and modeling relationships. Relational databases don't do a good job of encompassing graphs because graphs are not sets. Kind of a mathematical tautology. And finally, we have wide sparse columns. That's what an Azure table is. It's a key to a set of values. Each entity or row is self-describing as to its schema, and the schema can be variant within a table or a container. There are other ones, but Azure tables are the most common ones. So let's just kind of walk through and talk about what each of these are good for. All right, relational data stores. I'm not going to beat this one to death because let me ask a stupid question. Who hasn't used SQL before? That's what I thought. I don't have to throw anybody out. That'd be awkward. It may make you sit through 2.5 hours and then I throw you out. Okay, so Azure SQL Database, SQL Azure, is not SQL Server. They are two very different things. They look the same and they walk the same. They do not fly the same. SQL Server is an enterprise-grade, scale-up, kick-ass database, and I just went on record saying that and I'm happy to. It is hardcore. It works. We know what we can do with it. We know the bounds. SQL Azure, or Windows Azure SQL Database to use the marketing term, is a multi-tenant, high-density database as a service. If I want to spin up 300 or 400 small databases, I would never do that on premises. Your DBA would looking at you going, you want what? Do you know how much it costs me to manage all that stuff? Get out of my office. For SQL Azure, that's fine. That's perfectly normal. I just spin them up as API calls, and all that manageability experience is taken care of for me. I'm not worried about it anymore. What I can't have is a small number of very large databases with super IOPS at this point in time. And most of the friction, a buddy of mine, Connor Cunningham, uses the phrase, it's a fleet of Hondas, not of Ferraris. There you go. And that is the intent. That is the design intent of this service. And what people run into trouble with SQL Azure is they try and treat it just like, well, I just spent, you know, $1 million on this DL9 blah, blah, blah with a whole bunch of sand. I want your $6 a month SQL database to work just the same as that. And you kind of look and going, no, not so much. But it's fair for customers to have this mental model of, hey, they're both SQL, right? They're not. Key differences. This is multi-tenant. You can be throttled out. With basically the limits, the resource limits are a lot slower. All the queryability stuff is the same, but the databases are smaller. And once I have multiple databases, there is no transactional consistency between databases because distributed transactions are a symptom, not a solution. Database folks hate it when I say that. I'm working in a distributed system. Anything that has to make two things that are separated by some non-deterministic network the same requires everything to slow down to a snail's pace. Distributed transactions suck on premises. We just overcome them with fiber. You don't have that option in the cloud. So again, every database is largely an island. Scaling out is a little challenging because you had to scale out. You can't scale up. Manageability, you don't have to do a lot of the normal stuff, but as of right now, SQL Azure databases are fairly opaque. One good thing is they have a dynamic management view called the event table, which gives you information about throttling and usage metrics, much like storage logging will give you those values. .NET access, as a .NET application developer, I hate relational databases. They make me take my nice normalized view of the world and tear it apart and shred it in strange, unusual, and fairly unnatural ways. And most ORM technology is incredibly slow. Actually, I'm going to go as far as to say all full ORM technology is incredibly slow. If my choice is agility over throughput and density, this is an engineering decision. This is a business decision. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying I'm trading one for the other. And for business continuity at this point in time, this will change relatively soon, but I can't talk about when. If you have a SQL Azure database in one data center, you are responsible for GDPR. You are responsible for backups. And unfortunately right now, the backup strategy is clone and export. There is no native backup at this point in time. We have some great documents out there about how to choose between running SQL Azure or SQL in a VM in the forthcoming infrastructure as a service. Okay. Nothing serious here. You have to have a clustered index because of the way things are laid out on disk. The foreign keys cannot span databases, obviously. So there's no locality thing there. As well. All right, federations. Who's heard of federations? Don't use them. Next. Does anybody actually really want me to go into why? I'm happy to. So has anybody ever gotten the question from customers, why shouldn't I use federations, or I'm having a bad experience with it? I will cover this in detail when we talk about scalability and partitioning choices. I'll talk about the choices that federations made and the impact it has on customers. Right, document stores. Document stores are cool. So let's talk about MongoDB. So what is a document store? It says, all right, I'm an application. I think of the world as objects. So why don't I have a durable state store that also thinks of the world as objects, or documents, you might call them. So MongoDB, made by a company called TenGen, is a really great distributed document store that says, all right, I will store documents. I will index them. I will make them queryable. You will have the ability to have nested data structures. But what you give up is you give up strong coupling with other pieces of data. In a relational data model, you're always tightly stitched together. That is the core of relations. You have relationships between data. In a document-oriented database, all documents are an island. They may have pointers to other things, but this concept of a join does not exist. The reason you can't do joins is because these are explicitly partitioned. I have physically separate nodes. And trying to do joins across the network, physics is not on your side. So what can I do here? I can stand up documents, full nested data structures. I can index them, which means I get very efficient query and lookup. And I get some atomic operations, locks, increments, modifications, meaning that I have concurrency support. And the other really cool thing is I have some functional projection, meaning that I can push some aggregations, some forms of queries to the server and have it do rollups. So ad hoc document retrieval, I do get some MapReduce, so basically scatter, gather queries over large amounts of data in JavaScript. It's pretty efficient, works fairly well. I can add new servers, new shards, and new replica sets for availability online. I basically say, here's some more capacity, rebalance please. The system does that for you, it works quite well. Manageability, it's not fully integrated with Azure yet, you have to manage it yourself. We're used to doing that, that's where this is really more of an infrastructure as a service experience. It has a native .NET client with actually a pretty good link provider. So if I don't want to learn the MongoDB language, I can use link, and most of the operators are server-side projections. But you'll want to be careful so you don't accidentally end up downloading the entire database to count the number of rows. And you have to handle intra-DC resiliency yourself. Now, you can, MongoDB does have good support for asynchronous replicas, but you're going to have to know Mongo pretty well in order to get those up and running. Has anyone used MongoDB in your project? I would say this is, if you need a document store, if you need to be able to have kind of secondary indexes and secondary querying on rich documents, this is a great approach. When ours comes out, I may change my mind. I sincerely hope I change my mind. But I will only do that through successful deployments. All right, so let's just talk about a sample app in MongoDB. So normally I have this relational breakout here. In a document, I would actually condense all of these into a single document and send it up as an atomic entity. So I don't have my users in one table and my profiles in another. I have a user document that then contains a profile. And when I go, I can pull down the entire document or I can project pieces of the document. So it's okay to have relatively large data structures that are internally consistent. If I want to break them apart, I'll have references, but references require two round trips or three round trips. So that's just the design to watch out for. And the relations are duplicated for all entities. If I have shared, normally what you have in SQL is shared reference tables. In this world, you do not have shared reference tables. You're fully denormalizing the data, I always get those mixed up, into a common entity. So a lot of the tricks, the biggest, for this and for table storage, the biggest mistake I have seen is taking a DBA or relational schema designer and letting them loose in a new world, and they try their utmost, their very utmost, to make the new world look just like the old, and they're going, this thing is slow and doesn't work. Well, yeah, because you're using a screwdriver to hammer in a nail. It doesn't work. So it's one of these, you kind of have to take some of the, you have to take the success conditioning, because we've gotten good at designing a relational schema, and kind of park it off to the side and embrace this slightly screwy new way of doing things. Because what these distributed stores are doing is saying, okay, we're going to relax consistency between pieces of data. We're going to embrace partitionality, and we're going to get availability and scalability as a result. Those are the engineering trade-offs these systems explicitly make. Okay. So what is the support for MongoDB is the question. This is not related to HD Insight and the work for Hadoop on Azure. Tengen, the company that creates Mongo, offers standard support contracts through the Azure Store. Or the Azure Store, the Azure Marketplace. Anyway, this is there's official support, official commercial support contracts. Mongo itself is a GPL'd or LGPL'd server, so it's anathema to touch, but the client drivers are Apache licensed, meaning that we can freely use them under the auspices of an open source license agreement in our customer contracts, and we never touch the Mongo code directly. There's no binary linking dependency, so there's no open source virality from its use. And the Tengen guy, great folks, they're committed to supporting Azure, and they have good support contracts. All right, Azure Tables. Let's talk about Azure Tables. So, sparse column or array. Key, partition key, row key to a set of values. Operations within a single partition are relatively efficient. Think of it as a two-layer linked list. Really, it's kind of a two-layer tree, really. I can efficiently get to a partition based on its partition key. I can very efficiently get to a row based on its row key. And at the number of entities, I really should say entities, not rows, within a partition is relatively small, I can efficiently scan it. If I put 15 million entities in a table partition, I cannot scan it efficiently. It's just physics. There's no magic. So, functional projection. It's sort of none. Table storage allows me to do a couple of things. I can get a given, I can query by partition key and row key. That's a lookup. That's very efficient. I can query by partition. That's pretty efficient. That's a seek and then a scan. Or I can query for stuff. That's unbelievably inefficient because that's a scan, a retrieve, and a client-side lookup. So I have some basic filtering. I can also do a projection. So the only function that I can push out to the server is a basic filter based on partition key or row key and a projection saying I want these seven columns if they exist. Because I have orthogonal schema, not all entities in a table or in a partition are guaranteed or even likely to have exactly the same schema. What this does is your applications, so it's a lot, it's very challenging in a relational world to do schema change management, especially for large data sets, because everything has to either map to a common schema, either by extension or by upgrading everything. This is painful, it's awkward, it's slow. It's good for data continuity, it's good for data stewardship, it's very bad for application agility. So here the trade-off is, put in anything you want, it's okay, there's no kind of foreign key or tight schema validation. But now your application is responsible for understanding multiple versions of your data set. So you have to program defensively against the data store. Just a set of trade-offs. I happen to, for online services that are evolving quickly, I prefer this. Because you may not know from week to week or month to month what your data schema needs to look like. You may have to advance this very, very quickly. All right, scalability. This is very easy to scale. At the same time, it can be a little challenging. It all comes down to how do you pick your partition key? Do you have the right number of entities in a partition key? One of the very common bad patterns is a temporal insert. Essentially, I want to write records into a logging table. Well, I need to write it to a partition, and that partition needs to be deterministically computable, meaning I can't do a lookup to get the partition key against the central service because I just created a global choke point, a global failure point, I slowed everything down, and now I'm paying three times the network cost just to do an insert. So I've got to have some function that everybody has that can figure out the partition key. The most obvious one is, what's the current time? I will look at the machine time, I will compute a partition. The current minute, the current 5 minutes, the current hour, whatever. And I will write to that. Okay, it's simple, but what's the downside? Now everybody is writing into that same partition. I've just created a hotspot. Windows Azure Diagnostics does this. We'll talk about how to get around that later. And if I have a large number of instances all jamming into that same partition, I'm going to blow it out pretty quickly. So I need to think about how big is the partition for inserts. The flip side is, how big is it for queries? Say, for example, if I'm doing like, I want to store user profiles. It is perfectly acceptable to create 100 million partitions. It's just a metadata entity. The upside is perfect access. I can get right up to my storage account limit very easily because the number of operations against any individual partition might be one every now and then. The downside is if I need to get data about multiple users, that will be expensive because I need to go to each individual partition, assemble the results, and then stream them back. So that's the dynamic trade-off. How much do I put in a partition? How much is going in? How much is coming out? How much is being inserted? How much is being queried? For application data lookups, again, very acceptable, very common to put everything for a single user in one place. The only thing you have to trade off then, so I need to do reports against aggregate amounts of data, that's probably going to be exceedingly slow. No silver bullet. It is fully integrated with the Azure portal and diagnostics. I can get monitoring, metrics, and discrete logs for every single operation through configuration. That's a huge benefit. In terms of Azure readiness, it's just there. It's one of the foundational services of Azure and is very reliable. So I did need to change my .NET access slide just a little bit. I didn't upgrade the color there. This has gone from red to yellow. Link integration is gone in Storage 2.0. You do actually have to learn the native library. It's not terrible. Most of the table storage operations are pretty simple. Query for this, query for that. It actually forces you to think about the semantic model. I'm sure they'll come out with another link provider in the future. However, the .NET storage library no longer requires known or annotated types. Taking advantage of the dynamic type support in .NET, I can now pull down types. If I use the term duck typing, does anyone know what I'm talking about? A couple nods. So for those of you who don't, duck typing is defined as if it looks like a duck and walks like a duck and sounds like a duck, it's a duck. Meaning I have an object. If I treat it like a circle and it fulfills all the properties of a circle in a dynamic way, then it's a circle. It doesn't have to statically inherit from I am a circle. It just is. That's what duck typing is. And the dynamic keyword in .NET allows me to basically leverage duck typing against unknown things. I can grab an entity from a table, cast it to dynamic, and then treat it like a type. Or I can basically grab it and then statically cast it to a type. I have these options now in the new storage library. This is one of the areas I was talking about where, for the first time, the storage library actually exposes all the functionality of the service itself. Of course, duck typing, you can get into a lot of trouble because if something's not there, you either need to provide a default value or catch the cast problem and then work around it. So again, we're coming back to this theme of you're defensively programming against your state stores. Because we have multiple versions in flight and we have multiple applications potentially modifying schema and doing interesting things. So let's just talk about a sample application. So say for example we are modeling users as a table. The partition key is simple. It's just the user ID. As long as I have some way of creating globally unique user IDs, whether I'm using an actual text value, whether I'm using a GUID, this is very doable. Why would I use a GUID and not an integer?
GUID can be generated dynamically, result guaranteed to be globally unique. An integer is typically sequential, and now you have a choke point trying to determine what the next available integer is.
Fantastic. That's exactly the answer I was looking for. So just to repeat for the purposes of the recording, and I'll try and do it justice, is that an integer, if I need a monotonically increasing sequence, it doesn't have to necessarily be a contiguous sequence, but a monotonically increasing sequence requires a single point to create the sequence, or some really sophisticated distributed algorithms. But we'll just go with the simple way, which is you have one source of truth that is the sequence generator. That is a global choke point and a global failure point. And it's slow. Especially if I'm generating user IDs from mobile applications that must operate in an offline mode, if I can't get at the sequence generator, I cannot do anything. GUIDs can be deterministically generated in an isolated form. Anybody can generate a GUID, and to a very high degree of certainty, it's going to be unique. So I can then, in an isolated fashion, create the GUID and then push it in. In the database world, they're evil because they don't sequence, so they can't be sorted and indexed. Because the tables don't work that way, GUIDs are just fine. And in general, when we talk about devices and services-based applications, partially disconnected applications, integers are very dangerous. Yes, there is a performance penalty, especially in relational databases. I'm generally very okay with paying it. Because what you get, the problems you no longer have to solve, tend to outweigh that kind of inline throwing that number of bytes around. Most database folks are like, well, you're 32 bits or 128 bits, you're throwing away all that space. And my answer is, it's cheap and I don't care. And that's the thing about cloud. It's okay because the cost of the storage is so dramatically lower than it would be if it was a scale-up, SAN-backed relational store. Okay, so row ID. The row ID could be the user ID, or it could be a type. I could have a row that says profile, a row that says login stats, or I could just have a row that's also the user ID if I have a single entity. That's fine. Do whatever you want. And the properties are the user information, and I can have a lot of columns. I can't remember how many properties you can have. I can't even remember if there's a limit, as long as I'm under 64K.
255.
Yep. There you go, 255. One thing to watch out for when you're naming your columns, don't use big column names. When the entity is put in table storage, because every entity can have different schema, the schema is stored with the entity. The names of your columns count against the 64K limit. So if I have a column that is supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, I store an integer in there, I am not using my space efficiently. If you want to provide human readable names, do it in your application. I'm not saying have, you know, column A, B, C, and D. I had enough of that in the Fortran days. Yes, I programmed in Fortran. But by all means, keep the actual column names, the entity property names in table storage nice and tight. Otherwise, you're wasting space, and you may hit those 64K limit far sooner than you expected. Use GUIDs for distributed IG generation. We've already talked about the kind of the pros and cons there. And finally, the challenges. Unbounded lists. Tables are terrible at modeling arrays. Unless you play some tricks with, you cannot, it's very challenging to model an array in properties. You generally have to go to rows. And then you end up with this interesting challenge of, how do I then create the row keys? And then how do I infer the row keys? Or just look them all up. And deterministic partition keys. There's a number of different options where you choose time, some value, some extract. We could spend a lot of time talking about this. There's actually some great material out on MSDN. I'll make sure to include the link to it that goes through some of the choices that you have to make. One key thing to bear in mind, and this applies to blob names as well, is that the way storage works under the hood is it's actually looking at the string. It's looking at because the partition key is a string. So whether it's a partition key or whether it's a blob name, it's looking at it. And when it groups them, basically for locality, when it's pulling them into memory, it's bringing them online, making the partitions of the blobs hot. If you use an append strategy, for example, every new partition I increment the last digit, every new blob I increment the counter on the end, storage will not handle that efficiently. Because what it'll do is you're telling it, hey, all these things in close sequence are going to end up on the same set of nodes in the back end. So if you're looking at designing blob names or designing partition keys, you actually want the prepended values to be where your sequence is. Very small little change to your partition and naming functions that can have profound impact on scalability. This generally only happens in the high end, but just something you guys should be aware of. So if I have something that is, standard name, append sequence, instead, it should be sequence append standard name. Okay, and we're going to close out with distributed cache. One of my absolute favorites. If you had asked me before SDK 1.8 whether or not to use Azure caching, I would have said no. It's an abomination, run away screaming. Because it was. Distributed caching as a service. Remember we talked about load balancer traversal? If I want something that can get me data in 1 to 2 milliseconds, going through a NAT, across the network, through a load balancer, to an instance, and then back again, is generally not a good experience. Also, the throttling caps on the early versions of caching as a service. And I've told the cache team this, and I'm going to go on record and saying they were somewhere between asinine and insane. If I have a good resource-based cap, will say you get 1,000 ops a second. You exceed 1,000 ops a second, I'm kicking you out of the pool. A throttling policy that says you get 1,000,000 ops an hour has no relevance in technology. Because basically what it says is, you're good, you're good, you're good, you're good. Now you're not, and for the next 45 minutes or 17 minutes or some other period, you don't get in. This does not make any sense in a distributed cache. Do not use the shared service. So what I would recommend customers to do is to use Memcached. Excellent product, runs reasonably well in Azure, gave great performance. As of SDK 1.8, my recommendation has officially changed. Based on some battle testing, our dedicated caching capability on Azure is really, really good. It is as fast as Memcached, more reliable, with more features. So let's talk about what caching really does. If you need low latency, low consistency, primarily read access to key to blob data, distributed cache is your friend. It's key to byte array. This has some interesting ramifications. Because it's a blob, how you update a field in an object is you read the object, deserialize it, change it, reserialize it, and put it in the cache. What does this mean? If two different people, two different instances are trying to update the same entity, last writer wins. you have a serious consistency challenge. In Memcached, it was distributed cache. You don't get any consistency anyway. What are you worried about? Azure caching does have the ability to do optimistic concurrency and kind of timestamp-based updates, as well as mutual exclusion. If you are worried about throughput, do not use lock and unlock in distributed cache. It's there. Use it very carefully. It's very expensive. Okay. There are two modes that you can deploy Azure caching. One is as a shared service running on your web roles. Forget it exists. Don't ever use it. It's just there to lead you down the path of despair. The only reason for shared caching is when you're running very small sites and you're trying to co-locate for an optimization. It has no place in a production system. The only reliable, performant, deterministic way to run caching is as a dedicated worker role in your service. And here's why. So it's a distributed cache. It's arranged in a ring topology so that based on the key I ask for, it's allocated to one of those servers. So when I want that value, I go directly, point-to-point connection to the server that has it, get my data, and come back. So if I've run co-located, a request comes into web instance 1. I go to my co-located distributed cache. I come out, I go back over to web instance 2 that happens to have the cache, because co-located does not mean localized to my application requests. And I've done two things. The key thing I've done is I've stolen resources from web instance 2. And like all good distributed caches, this is a memory hog. It wants as much memory as it can get, and it will only give it back under pressure. So if I have user requests coming in one side and cache requests coming in the other, I will contend on memory, and I will do some very strange things. And now you are in the world of what we call Heisen bugs. They're there, and you look at them, and then they're gone. These are incredibly hard to debug. The only reliable way is a dedicated cache running on XL instances. Don't use the shared cache as a service. Don't use the shared roles. Okay, so very scalable. You can reliably expect to get 50,000 operations per second, read and writes unlocked, out of a single XL node. And you can go up to 32 nodes reliably. We have a number of systems running 32 XL nodes of cache in a service and just cranking along and doing wonderful things. It's directly integrated with the portal. You get manageability. You get stats. It just shows up. It's easy to deploy. You just say, please add a cache role in Visual Studio, and you're done. You need to say the role name for anybody that wants to access it, but it works. All right, ease of .NET access, NuGet, add cache storage, data factory, and I'm done with one line of config. What are the downsides? Because there's always downsides. I've talked about the semantic problem of you're not updating objects or updating a byte array. If you need mutual exclusion, you probably have a problem in your design. If you have to do locking, you may want to look at, are there other ways to streamline the access to the data? Consistency, trying to maintain consistency with what's in my cache and in my backing stores can be a bit of a problem. Question back? Is there a sweet spot in terms of load and number of instances? If you want high, so this cache also supports high availability, so that if I lose one of the instances, there's another node that can immediately start taking requests, which ties into your question. So in Memcached, if I lose a node, it's gone. I lost that whole partition of data, which means all the load that was going to the cache then convoys against my backing store and usually drops them on the ground. By default, the same thing will happen in Azure caching unless you want to turn on high availability. Turn on high availability, every write is mirrored to a secondary. You pay a latency cost for that. Basically, about triples your latency. But again, you're trading the throughput. So if you think about, I'm going to want at least two nodes because of update domains. For particularly large systems, I'm going to want more nodes so an individual node failure doesn't take out a large number of my systems. But generally, if you think about 25,000, it works out to about 12,500x requests per second per core. So I would just stand up more capacity than I needed, look at the numbers, and dial down as necessary. I don't say this about many things, but it's so efficient. You just generally stand up a bunch of capacity, let it run for a while, and go, oh, we got enough. Or we've got 50% headroom or 800% headroom, and then dial as necessary. It's always better to over-provision, let stuff run for a while and just see what happens. Good answer, bad answer? All right. All right, so we talked about cache. All right, with 4 minutes left, I'm right about where I wanted to be. And I'll just close out and I'll throw a few questions out just to see who's been paying attention, because I like doing that. My sense of humor is expansive. All right, there are a lot of options. They all have nuances. They all have trade-offs. I can talk about and give you guys a high-level description. The only way this is really going to make sense is to get your hands dirty, is to take each of these, take some problems, noodle over them, and see what they look like in the different forms and the different technologies, and think about the interrelationships between them. If I have the same data that's in cache as is mirrored in SQL and mirrored in table storage, where is the source of truth? The answer is there is no globally coherent source of truth. It depends on who you ask and when you ask them. Some applications can survive that, especially if you design for that from the beginning. Some can't. Some applications absolutely require tight internal consistency. Relational databases are good at that. You're giving up your throughput and your latency. It's okay. It's all these trade-offs. System capabilities, semantics, queryability, availability, scalability, what fits where. Your application will consist of multiple workloads. It's okay to have different state stores for different workloads in some cases. It's actually even fairly common. Do not default to relational. It's comfort. We know what we've been living there for a while. We know what it feels like. The couch is broken in. We can put our feet on the coffee table. Don't start there. I'm not saying don't end up there, but don't run to relational just because it's comfortable. It may not be the right solution. It may be, but challenge those assumptions. Most of the times, myself and my team get involved when things are, how should we say, a little bit flammable, has usually been because of the default, make everything relational for non-relational applications and non-relational data. That's why I always start with the semantic of the question and of the data. And it's a broad world out there. I encourage everyone to play with these number of things and just see what you can do. Lots of great tutorials, lots of great material, and it will help you guide your customers down paths where they can ultimately be more successful on Azure. And I'm happy to take a couple of questions or let you guys go for a bit of an early lunch.
Are we doing any guidance on persistent engines that can actually help us abstract where the storage of the thing is going to be used on
So the question is, what are we doing in terms of guidance? And if I can extend your question where I think you're going, frameworks and tooling to help make these decisions a little simpler. So I'll answer it in two pieces. One is, and I hate to be the bearer of bad news, right now, this is more art than science. The systems and their capabilities are changing fairly quickly. We don't have a unified mathematical background to base all of this stuff on. A lot of it is, I can sit down and I can look at a problem, having done this for 3 or 4 years, and I can extract a pretty good polyglot. I can't draw a flow chart that says this is how you do it. So unfortunately, it's a bit of an art form that you have to work through. The other side of it is, are there tools that can simplify this stuff? Yes, there are some common patterns and there are some common workflows. So when I think about, so one of the things that my team is working on right now with some customers is bundling up all of the Azure storage interfaces behind it, Azure storage platforms behind a common set of interfaces. So that if I want to join, if I want to flow data from tables to queues, it's, here's a table that presents an abstract interface that I can then connect through a thing that publishes out to blob storage or SQL or whatever. Has anybody used iObserver, iObservable? Okay, a couple of really cool people in the room. So everyone's used to enumerable. Pull, 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 pull. It's a great interface. It's very composable. I can sling lots of things together. But it has some downsides in that I have to control the rate at which data arrives. In a web application or an online services application, it's usually somebody else that's controlling the ingress of data and they're pushing it to me. Also, it's hard to control the life cycle of a pull-based operation. This is why we have cancellation tokens in enumerables. It's kind of awkward. It's a little dirty. Since .NET 4, well, really 3.5, but 4 it was codified, we have the inverse, the duality of enumerables, which are called observables, which is push-based collections. And we have a library called the Reactive Extensions. Anyone using Rx? It is the coolest piece of technology in .NET today with the absolute worst documentation. We intend to fix that, which allows you to describe your intent for streaming data. We've got some examples, and I'm happy to show them later this afternoon, where I can connect a web API to a queue, or read from a queue, do an inline transform, and publish to SQL with about 4 lines of code. All I need to do is to express my intent and let the system handle the rest for me. These are some new concepts. They're a little more advanced. We're still getting all the APIs right, but it's a little hint of composability in Azure is something that is critically important. We hope to see more product teams embrace it. As the customer advisor team and the guidance work we do, we're going to be pushing pretty hard so that when you do want to flow data, you spend time expressing your intent rather than dealing with all of the plumbing. Make sense? Cool. One other in the back. Oh, Neo4j? Not direct. I haven't dropped, so my bar, I didn't talk about it earlier. I'll talk about it in the next slide. My bar to talk about anything in detail, it's 1 million users, 100,000 requests a second, globally dispersed, with at least 3 nines uptime. I have folks that I've worked with that have used Neo4j pretty successfully. I personally have not. I hear good things about it, but I can't go into detail. It's on my list of, here are the things I need to go and get my hands dirty with. So if you go and use it and have some great experiences, please let us know.
Additional videos in this series can be found on Channel 9 at http://channel9.msdn.com/series/failsafe. In addition, Microsoft Services and the Azure Customer Advisory Team have produced white papers and guidance on these subjects. You can find these on the Azure Architecture Center at http://www.windowsazure.com/en-us/develop/net/architecture.